It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a documentary showcasing some of the different sides of post-traumatic stress disorder had its Green Bay debut last night. We'll talk to the Wisconsin-born executive producer. First, for children in the foster care system, transitioning to adulthood can be a daunting experience. In Wisconsin, kids age out of the system at 18 years old. According to the National Foster Youth Institute, across the country, an average of 23,000 kids age out of the system every year, and some 20% of these young adults become instantly homeless. In Wisconsin, there are resources available to help with that transition, but these can vary from one community to another. Later, we'll talk to a sociologist about the challenges facing young people as they move out of foster care. First, we talked to a children's advocate who recently established a new transitional resource for these kids in the Chippewa Valley. Joe Luganbill is founder of the Luganbill Children's Foundation and the Smile House, a resource center and home for young adults aging out of the state's foster care system. It's scheduled to open next year. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about the inspiration for the Smile House.
Well, the Smile House is really something that first came to mind in 2016 when I was working as a caseworker with kids in foster care in Eau Claire County. And I had many conversations, far too many conversations, with young people who were 17 and a half or 18 on their caseload and in the process of what's called aging out. And they had nowhere to go. And having those conversations, it made it abundantly clear to me that there was a real gap in services and a real lack of a continuum of services for young people when they age out of foster care and have nowhere to go. And I think that's a big reason why, you know, there's the national statistic that 1 in 5 young people who ages out of foster care, they automatically become homeless. And so I knew then that I wanted to get a program going. And I, when I initially started telling people that I wanted to open up a house for that population, a lot of people were a little bit hesitant, weren't sure that we'd be able to make it happen, just because it's a daunting task. But now that we have a building, it's all the more real, and it's really exciting.
What kind of services would the Smile House provide to someone in that situation who ages out of the foster care system?
Well, the services are in the acronym, really. So the acronym of Smile House is support system, mentoring, independent living, and education. So first, having that support system, having a stable living environment for as long or short as they need, where they have an individualized resident plan that also can help tailor services that meet their needs. So perhaps they need assistance with getting access to mental health services or substance use treatment, or perhaps they're looking to get connected with a counselor and talk about career options, technical school or a trades program or a four-year college. Just looking at having that support system, having the mentoring also, so having a stable and supportive atmosphere where there are adults who can serve as mentors, when there are peers who can serve as mentors, having that opportunity for independent living. So we know that's so important because often they do not have that opportunity. They go right from foster care to becoming homeless. They don't have any sort of a transitional program to help them build those life skills that they really need to be successful. And really those life skills that all of us who were not in foster care and had our own families that were with us until we, you know, grew up, they helped us with those things. So making sure that we have those kinds of services and programs, and then, of course, education, because that's a big goal of the house, is that with everyone who lives there, we really focus on making sure that we can help meet their goals educationally and with moving forward in their career and in their education.
You can see how this would benefit the individual clients of the Smile House. How do you see this impacting the wider community in the Chippewa Valley area?
Well, what I really see is that this kind of a model isn't just needed in Eau Claire, my hometown. It's also needed in communities across the state and, frankly, across the country, because this is such a gap in services. And we know what happens when there is such a gap. We know the statistic that 1 in 5 who ages out of the system, they automatically become homeless. Now, when that happens, they automatically, or as a byproduct of becoming homeless, there's that opportunity that they might end up in another system. They might end up in the criminal justice system. They might end up being a victim of sexual abuse or of human trafficking. There are so many statistics out there that really indicate that young people who age out of the foster system and are in this kind of an experience where they become homeless, they have no support system, a lack of resources, a lack of connection, they fall prey to so many other societal ills and challenges, which ultimately costs everyone. It costs everyone time, it costs everyone money, and more than anything, it's an opportunity cost, because you're losing out on the potential that young people have when you don't invest in them when they need to be invested in. So I see it as an essential service, not just for the residents, but yes, for the communities, because it will be able to prevent so many other things. It will be able to help build stronger young people. It will help build resiliency for these youth, and it will help build a stronger community by virtue of that.
As we wrap up, Joe, what are the next steps for Smile House and the wider effort in the community to help foster kids who age out of the system?
Well, it's going to be an ongoing challenge, because we see more and more young people going into foster care, and so we will see more and more aging out of foster care. As far as our next steps with the Smile House, we hope to have it opened in 2020, and so for the next 4 months, 5 months, we will be remodeling the house. We have a variety of different projects underway there right now, and then we will be getting a staff and volunteer plan together and opening it up. And we'll be working with outside agencies to refer residents who would live at the house, and also allow for people to self-refer if they think that the Smile House would be a good fit for them.
Joe, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much.
Joe Luganville is the founder of the Luganville Children's Foundation and the Smile House in Eau Claire. That's a resource center and home for young adults aging out of the state's foster care system. Now we take a look at resources available statewide to people as they age out of foster care, and what Wisconsin and local communities can do to set them up for success. Ellen Smith is a clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Social Work. She's worked in child welfare for over 25 years, including working in child protective services as a social worker. Ellen, welcome back to Central Time. Ellen, are you there? I think we've lost Ellen Smith. We'll take a brief pause. And you can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. If you have a personal experience to share, if you were a child in foster care, a foster parent, or someone who's worked in the system, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about kids as they age out of the foster care system. Ellen Smith joins us now, clinical associate professor in the UW-Madison School of Social Work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have experience in the foster care system as a parent, somebody who's worked with foster children, or as someone yourself who's been in foster care, love to hear your story. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ellen Smith, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of people might think, okay, when kids go into foster care, it's a temporary setup. Either they're reunited with their birth family, or they get adopted. But talk about when that doesn't happen and kids end up hitting 18 and they're still in foster care.
Yeah, so as your previous guest talked about, there's about 23,000 kids who age out of our foster care system every year. And these are children who have families. They know who their families are, but for a variety of reasons, they were needing to be in the foster care system through their growing up years.
And talk about some of the challenges they face. We heard a little bit about that as we were talking about the Smile House, but statewide, what are the obstacles someone might face as they age out of foster care?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked about that. And I want to just invite your callers and your listeners to just think about maybe the children that they parented who turned 18 or their own experiences as young adults. you know, nothing magical happens at the age of 18. I would venture a guess that most of the people that are listening to you today continue to have contact with their social support networks and their families. And so this idea that something magical happens at 18 and that kids will be able to live independently is really a fallacy. And the kids that are in the foster care system often have additional challenges, such as, you know, significant trauma histories, mental health diagnoses. A number of our aging out women have had children with them or have had even previous juvenile justice involvement. And so those are added challenges for those folks as well. And so when I think about what are the challenges, most of them are the typical challenges that any of us who have kids that age have. They don't know how to go to the doctor. They don't have anywhere to go for, you know, Thanksgiving meal, or know what to do when they get a flat tire, all those kinds of things.
And as we just heard, a substantial number of 18-year-olds then, as they leave the foster care system, don't necessarily even have a place to live. How common is that?
About 39%. There's a big study that was called the Midwest Study. So these are our kids in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa, where they looked at these outcomes for kids over a long period of time. And by the age of 24, 39% of the kids in this study had been homeless at least once or had been couch surfing since they had left foster care. So housing is a huge issue for these kids.
What kind of services are available that we could say, okay, wherever you are in the state, you can get these kind of services, before we dig into what might be different from community to community?
Well, you know, we certainly have things like Badger Care that kids, you know, can sign up for. If kids are aging out of the foster care system, they are entitled to continue to receive services from their county human service agency, which includes some educational assistance that they could get if kids want to go on and get a associate's degree or a bachelor's degree, those kinds of things. So there are some financial resources for kids that are available statewide.
And we just heard about the Smile House being developed now in Eau Claire. Are there other local community efforts to help those 18-year-olds as they age out of foster care?
This is the first time I've heard of someone running a private-type facility that would bring kids in and provide them with that array of services. But there are certainly communities around the state, county agencies that have tried to put together types of support groups and different groups that help people with independent living skills.
For people who age out of foster care, you were touching on some of the homelessness numbers. What other kinds of long-term consequences do we see if people leave the foster care system and they don't have those family and personal systems in place?
So I think it's important to note that that most of these kids do have some kind of family. And so there are things that we can do when we are helping in the communities for both kids before they age out and afterwards to help continue those relationships. These kiddos, one of the things that we found out is that if we can provide a housing, stable housing, support for education, some mental health and health care for these kids, they do achieve, you know, have educational attainment. They do tend to stay out of the criminal justice system. They do delay childbearing, and they have some, you know, good outcomes that way. When the support goes away, though, we start to see those same types of you know, challenges start to emerge again. And so I think that, you know, this idea that there's going to be something that we can do really quick for a couple of years to support kids is probably not going to be enough. There are a lot of other systems that need to be available to these kids as they move through their adult years as well.
We're talking about foster care in Wisconsin, and what happens when people age out of the foster care system? They're in foster care, they exceed the age of 18, and what happens next? Ellen Smith is with us, clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Social Work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Was this you as a youth aging out of the foster care system? If you're a foster parent, what did you see after a foster child left your care, maybe after they turned 18 or 19? If you worked in the system in some capacity, what needs do you see out there? You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Becky is with us in Beloit. Becky, hi.
Hi. My question is, do you know if anybody partners with, like, military recruiters to help the people who are 18 maybe get into the military, get a sense of self and community and helping the country and, you know, an education that way?
Becky, thanks for the call. Ellen, have you seen anything like that?
That's a great question, and I actually have, I don't know the answer to that. I know that children who are getting close to aging out do have, are required to go through some sort of independent living, which includes making a plan for the future, which would be looking at kind of those post-high school, you know, what do you want to do in terms of getting a job or the military or those kinds of things. But I don't know of any specific program that does partner with the military.
Yeah, are there other, thanks for that call, are there other systems in place to help not just make a plan for jobs, but maybe to connect kids aging out of the foster child system with employers?
So there are programs around the country as well to help provide extra supports for kids if they want to go on to secondary education. Mm-hmm. So there are scholarships that are available, and then some universities also provide like summer housing or mentoring programs to connect kids who've aged out of the foster care system with faculty or community volunteers, so they have somewhere to go over those breaks when the dorms are closed. Hmm. So those are some programs that have shown success. There are also some programs that work with kids as a kind of getting ready for secondary education programs, so residential programs that teach kids how to, you know, how does college work and how do you do your laundry and live on your own and balance your budget and those kinds of things.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Pierre in La Crosse. Pierre, hi.
Hello, how you doing? I'm a social worker in Minnesota, and I work with youth that are aging out of care. And we have an extended foster care program where the youth have to either work or go to school in order to be in part of the program. And also they receive a monthly stipend to help them with their finances. And I've seen a lot of success with the kids that are in the program, and most of them are either enrolled in school or working. And they can stay in that program today or 21 years old.
Interesting, Pierre. Thanks for that call. Have you seen that kind of optional extended foster care with a few strings attached, as Pierre mentioned, Ellen?
Yes, there is. There are some federal guidelines that allow people to extend foster care. First, it was age 21, and now it allows you to do that to age 24. And so different states are experimenting with what that looks like and what a supported living situation might be, whether or not they should require those kids to have a job or not. One of the challenges that we found in that is that some kids, they kind of, you know, not unlike kids who aren't in foster care, they don't want adults telling them what to do when they turn 18. And sometimes they want to try it on their own. And so it's really important that these systems that extend foster care give kids a chance to, you know, maybe fall down and have things not work out so well and have a soft place to land. So that they can come back maybe even at the age of 19 or 20 and say, I really need a place to live, I need a place to stay, and I need some help.
Thanks for that call, Pierre. We'll bring on Lori now in Marinette. Lori, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lori?
Just wanted to talk about medical issues and food and nutritional needs also being met is a priority that would be on my list. Helping the individuals.
Lori, thanks for the call. Ellen, you mentioned Badger Care as one part of that picture. Anything else out there when it comes to health and nutritional needs that Lori's bringing up?
Yeah, that is certainly something that these kind of supported living environments can provide for kids. But also remembering, I'm glad she raised that, because sometimes we think about just finding kids, getting them a college scholarship or helping them to get a job, but really providing that kind of support so that kids can get those medical needs met. At least a third of the kids who enter the who age out of the foster care system do have some type of mental health need. And oftentimes one of the really critical times for these kids is when they're aging out and they're, you know, moving to independence. They really do need to make sure that they have their chronic medical needs taken care of. and that somebody's helping them to do that so that they don't lose their care.
Thanks for that call. Let's talk about when kids are teens still in foster care. Is there enough support, as you see it, Ellen, for foster parents to do what they can to make sure that kid can leave and be as independent as possible when they age out of the system?
Yeah, that's one of the expectations in being a foster parent. But I would also say that just like, you know, other kids who are not in foster care, there's often a whole support system that provides some of those. It might be a coach that teaches a kid about responsibility and taking care of his hockey gear. Or, you know, there might be somebody else who helps teach a kid to drive or teaches, you know, teaches you how to bake Christmas cookies or whatever your family traditions are. And so there's room for more than just foster parents, but for whole communities to be able to lend a hand and provide that system to support kids as they move on and age out. And the other thing that I've heard from a number of foster kids as they've gotten into their teen years and then aged out is they also need some support in how to manage the relationships that they have with their biological families. You know, if they have, you know, parents or relatives that maybe aren't the most supportive to them, helping them and supporting them to be able to set boundaries and know how to have healthy relationships is another thing that's really important.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Ellen, do we have enough foster parents out there in Wisconsin?
We never have enough foster parents. In addition to that, we also need places for kids to go for the holidays when they're aging out. They, you know, you don't have to provide 24/7 care in order to really make a difference in the life of a young person. You maybe you can just be a resource in teaching a kid about how to manage money or how to cope with their families or how to deal with a broken down car or, you know, how do you pay a bill or deal with, you know, setting up a bank account? So there are opportunities for all of your listeners to help support our youth in the state of Wisconsin.
Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ellen Smith is a clinical associate professor at the UW-Madison School of Social Work. She joined us today to talk about challenges facing kids as they age out of the foster care system in Wisconsin and the resources that are out there to help them. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with the executive producer of a documentary about PTSD that premiered last night in Green Bay. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, tariff costs reached a record high in September. We'll talk about the ongoing trade dispute between the U.S. and China and where that fight could head next. First, post-traumatic stress is best known as a problem for military veterans, but it also affects lots of other people who have faced trauma in their lives. And for people coping with the symptoms, sometimes the best resources are other people with PTSD. Those are some aspects of PTSD that Kimberly Resch highlights in her new documentary, Light in the Darkness, Living Well After Trauma. The Wisconsin native is executive producer of the film, which had its Green Bay premiere last night. She joined us yesterday from our Green Bay studio. Kimberly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Can you talk about why you and your colleagues tackled this very important issue of PTSD in this documentary?
Well, there was, I would venture to say there was a lot of different reasons, one of which was a personal journey, and then the others was every person I was talking to had their own story. And although they didn't all turn into post-traumatic stress disorder, they were feeling the stressors, and it was leading to differences in behaviors for people. So I was actually talking with them about the symptoms of the things they were having, and nobody was really talking about what created those symptoms to begin with. So we took a deeper dive, and of course, we at Conscious Content are really into humanitarian issues, and one of which is mental health. The fact that it affects one in five people across the United States, that was a really staggering number for most of us. And although those numbers are considerably less for PTSD themselves, like 8 out of 100, it was a conversation that we were finding nobody was having, not at work, not within the EMS. They have an influx of people who have issues, but they're not actually talking about what PTSD is or how they've gotten it to get to the root problem. So at the end of the day, we were looking for solutions. Like, we're reverse engineering. We're like, okay, there's PTSD, but how did that become a thing? Now, most of the people associate PTSD with like a Vietnam vet.
Right.
That's probably the biggest thing, or Soldier's Heart. And of course, they were exposed to massive amounts of trauma, and that makes perfect sense. But it's highly documented, right? It's the other ways that people get PTSD that nobody really talks about. And it could be like from something as small from the outside that looks like a car accident. You know, there's trauma. Like I have a lot of different smaller triggers that people see and they're like, gosh, why is she like that? Well, I guess if you're in a car accident and you were in a coma and you maybe don't remember the whole thing, but whatever, and you slam on your brakes or somebody in the driver's seat slammed on their brakes, that your cells don't forget. And we talked to some therapists last night, ironically at dinner, and they were talking about your cells remember everything you've been exposed to. And so just the fact that your frontal lobe or your brain or your normal beta brain state is not processing it every minute, your body remembers. So when you go into a specific situation that you weren't even planning on being in because it was a surprise, your body knows exactly how to react to it. And in that reaction where your cortisol levels are so high and you go into a fight or flight, basically, which most of us have experienced when we've been scared, if those feelings are not filed properly in your brain, the way that your body knows how to process them or should process them in a perfect situation, you end up with post-traumatic stress, which is normal. It turns into a disorder or into a condition, I guess, more than a disorder, because at the end of the day, you've not processed it. Your brain doesn't know where to file them. And that is what Dr. King was speaking about in our film. And that's what Dr. Seahorn speaks about in our film is, if you don't really know what it is and you don't know how to file it immediately, it goes kind of floating around in your brain matter. And when you're exposed to something else, at the end of the day, that trigger comes and you could be speaking to somebody at work. They say something, it triggers you, and all of a sudden your mood changes.
And Kimberly, I want to jump in. You share a lot of stories from people dealing with post-traumatic stress. Some who, as you mentioned, were deployed, active duty military. Some people, sexual assault survivors, other cases. Can you talk a little bit about how that affects them in their daily lives?
Well, I think it's different for every person, and that's the one thing that we want to hit home, especially all of our doctors that have been our medical board for this, because we wanted to make sure things were accurate and we were portraying real information to people. What happens is every expert that we interviewed said every person is going to deal with even the same situation in a different way based off of all of the experiences they've had since they were born or even before then. So knowing that, really personalized healthcare is super important, especially in the medical health arena, where people really learn to ask the right, like healthcare professionals learn to ask the right questions so that way they can understand. But in our film, Dr. Tony Seahorn, he reacts differently. He reacted he'll be the first person to say, I mean, he didn't know why he was angry. He couldn't literally, I think in the film even says, you can't run away from yourself. Like you're having these things that are happening to you and you're running away from yourself. And then Mike Fassens, who's actually a Green Bay native, who's amazing. He works for our sponsor, ironically, KI, who's taken a really beautiful interest in mental health. They have an amazing wellness program through KI, which I believe house about 900 employees just in the Green Bay area. They're quite large. And at the end of the day, Mike Fassens was able, even though his story was really hard on him to talk about it publicly, which even to this day, he may come tonight, he may not, but he just wanted people to know that they're not alone. And that was really important. And he was an Afghani veteran. We do have some other people like Dr. John King, who took all of his trauma from when he was like 2 on, which was one of the worst stories I've ever heard in my entire existence, and turned it into a book. One of them is No Working Title, and the other one is Deal With It. And in those books, he gives people tools. If you feel like this, this is what you should try. And some of those tools are as simple as just make your bed. Like, just wake up and make your bed.
Hmm. I want to give a listen to John King, one of the people whose stories you share in the documentary. At one point, he says he experienced a recall of his trauma while he was leading a church congregation. He assembled some members to talk about it. And I want to give a listen to what he said about their reaction.
They automatically jump to conclusions. And because of the stigma attached to mental illness, they just judged me. They just cast aspersions and judgment, came to conclusions about what I would do, what I wouldn't do, what I wasn't able to cope with. I think they stopped seeing me. They stopped seeing me try. They saw a broken person. which wasn't necessarily the case. But if you're told that all the time, then they come to believe that. Because I think, you know, people have a difficulty processing things.
And that, it seems like, is part of the mission of your film, not just awareness of PTSD, but also breaking down some of the stigma that surrounds it. Can you talk about that?
Yes, actually, stigma is probably, stigma is one of the most important key elements of what we're trying to do, because at Conscious Content, we create awareness and education. And so what we're finding is that something profound happens when people are educated. And so even with our premiere that's going to be happening, all of those people that are in there, half of them might be professional, half of them might need help. We don't know, but both of them are going to receive the same message. And that is going to be that there's always hope for PTSD. It isn't necessarily a disorder. It's really a condition that happens from an abnormal situation you've been through. Your brain is really just trying to process through it, and it's going to be different for everyone. And so breaking the stigma, having our police and our fire EMS workers not feel uncomfortable to try to get help after they've seen a tragic event, which they can get what's called complex or compound PTSD, which is the layering effect. Human trafficking victims also receive PTSD, complex PTSD, because they are reintegrated into a violent situation on a regular basis. And that works a little bit differently than that. And one of our panelists this evening, Jennifer Jameson, she works with human trafficking victims. And Sherry Lindberg, who's a highly accredited therapist, is going to educate us on brain spotting, which has also been in the film and has a really high efficacy rate. And the people that have had therapy that we know is effective, those people are learning that their disease, if you will, or their current situation is not how they're going to end their story. And that is part of what our mission at Conscious Content is.
Talking to Kimberly Resch, executive producer of the new documentary Light in the Darkness, about PTSD and treatment and recovery. And something that really struck me, Kimberly, so many of the people you profile in the documentary, not only dealing with their own issues, not only finding ways to heal, but also then reaching out to be, I think they use the phrase, a light in the darkness, exactly the title of your documentary, to other people, to reach out and not just help themselves, but others. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. We there's quite a few people, and we have four women from Wisconsin themselves. Brenna Ang Rankin is one of them, and she was a domestic and sexual abuse survivor. Her story is incredible. She's going to be on our panel tonight, but the amount of education that she's self-educating, it's been a six-year ordeal for her for doing the right thing to help protect and to save her daughter. So you have to decide that if you're... Sorry.
That's okay. Take a moment.
I think what happens when you get to know these people, you realize how brave they are.
Yeah. I took that away from this too. It is a really powerful moment when they share the ways they help others. Kimberly, as people watch this, and I hope a lot of people do watch it, what are you hoping they take away and share with others about maybe their own PTSD?
I think the level of awareness of whether you have it or not probably is the biggest cornerstone from a movie like this that creates education and awareness. I've also noticed that I receive hundreds of messages a week from people, and they have told their stories. And I get emotional because...
Of course.
So many people are suffering and no one's talking about it. So when you make a film like this, you have to put yourself out there. You hope that someone becomes a light in your darkness. I'm so sorry.
No. How could you not? How could you not feel like that after all these stories you've seen and told?
There's just so many amazing stories out there. There's so many strong people, and we just need to remove the stigma. It's really important to have hard conversations with your kids, with our law enforcement, with our teachers, with our friends. So many college students are suffering right now, and nobody's talking about it. So if you could just help us to start to create a conversation, I think that will be really huge for everyone.
Kimberly, thank you so much for sharing this with us today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Kimberly Resch, executive producer of the documentary about post-traumatic stress disorder, Light in the Darkness, Living Well After Trauma. We talked to her yesterday ahead of the film's Green Bay premiere last night. Coming up, a look at the cost of tariffs. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some state Democrats are advancing a bill that would legalize physician-assisted suicide in Wisconsin. We'll hear from a sponsor and a critic of the idea. First, new figures show that American businesses and consumers paid more than $7 billion in tariffs on imported goods. Many of those tariffs are part of the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China. Our next guest has been covering the issue, joins us now to break down the numbers. Megan Casella is a trade reporter for Politico Pro. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the U.S. has had tariffs on the books for a good chunk of time now since President Trump took office. What are we seeing in the numbers now in these new reports as to how much we're paying for tariffs?
We're starting to get some figures back put out by various coalitions showing exactly how much American consumers and businesses are paying for these. And so the latest figures that we're seeing this week are showing that in September alone, the U.S. consumers and businesses paid more than $7 billion in tariffs. It's the highest in U.S. history, and that more than $4 billion of those, so more than half of what was collected in September, is because of tariffs that the Trump administration has imposed over just the last year or so, or about a year and a half. So we're seeing those numbers skyrocket. I mean, there's no way around it. You know, the data shows just how much Americans are paying.
President Trump has made the case that ultimately China is paying these tariffs. The reports seem to suggest, no, it's consumers and businesses. What about this argument over who the money is ultimately coming from?
Trump does say that every now and then we hear the president talk about how China is paying these tariffs. And it is true that China is certainly hurt economically as well, but this data is looking at exactly what Americans are paying. If you think about it, an American importer that wants to either buy something directly from China, a good that's produced there, or a business that wants to import just a part that they're putting into a larger product, those are the people that have to pay these higher costs when they're importing Chinese goods into the United States. And so as we tariff more and more items, it's affecting more and more consumers and businesses who may have perhaps initially, especially on the business side, tried to eat some of that extra cost themselves, but eventually it has to trickle down to the consumer in some way.
The goal of tariffs in part would be to help protect American manufacturers, which I imagine is happening some, but from what you were just saying, it sounds like there might be manufacturers who buy parts or raw materials from China or another country that are actually being hurt by the tariffs. Do I have that right?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, even the most made in America good, certainly some products are 100% made in America, but I'd say a vast number are, you know, compiled of parts that are, depending on how complicated the product is, compiled of parts that are imported from all over the world. And so in many cases, they're imported from China because that's the most cost-effective place to import them from. And other scenarios, it's because it's the only place that some of these parts are made and can be imported from. And so it's a complicated situation. But while the administration says this is to protect American manufacturers, there's no doubt that there's a larger number of consumers and businesses and some manufacturers that are sort of hurt negatively.
Well, if I can make it even more complicated, we have a series of tariffs that have been put in place, tariffs that would be put in place once a deadline is hit. Sometimes those deadlines get extended. Can you give us a sense of the scope of products that have tariffs on them? We don't need to get into each specific trade category, but broadly, what are we seeing tariffs on?
We're seeing tariffs on a huge number of items. So one of the reasons that this data in September is so much higher than we've seen in the past is because a new round of tariffs took place on September 1st that had some consumer-facing items on there. So some apparel, some tools, some electronics, and that those are the sort of items that everyday Americans are buying every day. And those are some of the things that are finally getting hit with tariffs. The Trump administration, up until September 1st, had been trying to reduce the number of those consumer-facing goods that face tariffs. But as of September 1st, some of those did take effect, and there's another round that could take effect December 15th. And those are some of the things that could really hit Americans' wallets, things like cell phones and laptops and some items that are already pretty pricey that would only get more expensive.
This $7 billion number, that is just about what people are paying on tariffs and businesses are paying on tariffs for products coming into the country. Another point of concern is what isn't being exported out of the country because of retaliatory tariffs and countries like China moving to other countries for sourcing. That's a whole separate line item, right?
Absolutely. And that's sort of where it gets clear that both countries are hurting from this. I mean, China We're not importing as much from China. We're paying more to import from other countries. And the same works in reverse, that we can't sell as much to China because they're trying to punish us in much the same way. Because we already don't sell as much to China as they sell to us, they can't impose a directly proportionate amount of tariffs as we can. They can't hit quite as many products just because we already don't sell that many. But they can certainly put in their own measures, retaliatory measures, to try to reduce how much American manufacturers and farmers in particular can sell overseas.
Talking to Megan Casella, trade reporter for Politico Pro, looking at the ongoing trade dispute with China and the impact of tariffs. Megan, a big goal for these tariffs on the U.S. side is to bring China to the table, have a stick here to motivate China to meet us halfway on trade disputes. What's the latest status of negotiations between the U.S. and China?
As of today, things are looking pretty positive. The president announced a couple of weeks ago that the U.S. and China were really close to what he's calling a phase one agreement, which isn't as broad and comprehensive as the Trump administration originally set out to accomplish, but it's a step forward, and it's a way of sort of calming the waters, perhaps removing some of the tariffs, or at least not imposing some of those that are threatened, such as those on laptops and cell phones that I mentioned. And as of today, what we heard overnight from China is China's Ministry of Commerce is saying that both sides have agreed to start removing some of those tariffs in phases as part of that deal. It's a very incremental step because, for one, the U.S. is not yet confirming that, and it means that this is only something that will start to happen. This tariff rollback will only start to happen if and when they do sign a phase one deal, and we don't have a date for that yet. But it does show that things are looking positive, and that there might be sort of a step forward to calm the markets a little bit, calm both countries' economies, and perhaps keep moving forward in goodwill.
But that sounds like, okay, we're going to work on ending the tariffs on both sides that arose from this trade dispute. Is there talk of, I guess, what might happen in phase two of trying to remedy some of the concerns people have had with China on trade issues fundamentally?
That's the issue. That's where a lot of the criticism that is about how these China talks are going, that's where it comes from, because all we're seeing in phase one, or much of what we're seeing in phase one, is talk of calming the waters that were only started in this administration to try to get China to the table. Phase two still looks pretty far off because we haven't even completed phase one yet. But while there might be some structural changes included as part of phase one, most of those changes in terms of China's handling of intellectual property and technology transfers and these broader systemic issues that really started this dispute in the first place, those are getting kicked down the road. And there's no clear path forward or clear timeline or even a clear indication that those things will definitely be solved as part of this dispute.
Leading into the 2016 elections, there was a lot of controversy about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's going to be the U.S. and a bunch of other countries, not China, having a trade deal together. And now here we are. It's just these unilateral discussions between the U.S. and China. Is there any sense that we might have lost some bargaining power by not coming to the table with an agreement with a double-digit list of other countries?
It depends on who you talk to, but the camp that feels that we should have been part of the TPP definitely feels that way. The Obama administration branded that deal as a way of countering China. It was a way of bringing together a dozen countries to put all of their economic weight, more than a third of the global economy, together to counter China, and to say, you know, we should get more countries on board with us rather than getting on board with China and their practices. And so that camp certainly says, why are we going this alone when we have this way of approaching Beijing? And we had a method in place, a long-term game of how we were going to do this. What the Trump administration says is that the TPP wasn't beneficial to the U.S. for a variety of reasons. He did not hesitate on his campaign promise to withdraw from that deal. And he says that the reason we're now going at it alone was because we couldn't get other countries to be as aggressive as we were right off the bat. You know, they didn't want to risk their own domestic economies and get on board with us as quickly as we wanted to. And so we decided to go it alone because it was the only way. So, you know, you can see there's differences in those arguments. And it just depends, I think, on which camp you want to get on board with.
Megan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Megan Casella is a trade reporter for Politico Pro. She joins today to talk about the cost of tariffs and how the United States and China continue to handle ongoing trade disputes. New report estimates $7 billion in costs to U.S. consumers and businesses. Halloween's over, so it's time for Christmas music. According to an online trend company, yes. Based on web searches, playlists, and more, we're starting to listen to carols and seasonal songs. Tennessee and Michigan more so than most states. Wisconsin apparently in the middle of the pack. I say too soon. Producer Bill Martins disagrees. Hey, Bill.
Jingle bells, Batman smells, Robin laid an egg.
Yeah, it's never too soon for you. You love the songs of Christmas, the holidays, the winter.
Well,
you're a fan.
Yeah,
you can't get enough of them.
Well, I don't know if that's
true.
I can't listen to
mouth.
This in the like Father's Day weekend. I get,
okay,
you know.
Fair.
But I mean, like, so I understand that people want to wait until Thanksgiving before they finally start getting into the Christmas stuff. Makes sense. I get it. The problem I have is that the time goes by so fast between Thanksgiving and Christmas that you really don't have any time to enjoy it. So you have to start early.
Well, and especially this year, it's a late Thanksgiving, which retail stores are very aware of. They're worried they're not going to have as long a shopping holiday.
Right.
And you're worried we're not going to have enough time for our music.
Right, exactly. And it's, I don't go out of my way to listen to it, but if I happen to flip through the stations and it's there, I'll listen to it. Or if I go to a store, I don't get all hacked off because they're playing Jingle Bells or something. Mm. But the thing that I have a bigger problem with is on December 26th, when the stores and the radio stations and the movie channels, they can't get rid of Christmas soon enough. I'd like to extend that to at least New Year's.
All right, we'll go out with a little holiday seasonal music. And with our musical theme yesterday, this is Central Time.
I want to wash my hands, my face and hair with snow.
Snow, I long to clear a path and lift a spade of snow.